Hi, Sabina.
Good morning.
Morning.
We'll get started in just a minute here. I think Sam's trying to figure out how to make himself talk so everybody can hear him.
Sabina, as Matt shared the protocol we put together down here for Mercy and Cox Health EMS.
He did. Tom sent it to me yesterday, and I forwarded it to the Regional Medical Directors Group. We're going to talk about it on Tuesday with the East Region meeting, the East Region protocol as well.
Cool.
All right. Sam, are you there? Okay. So Sam's trying, but he can't talk to us. So let me me just a minute to pull up the comments that he was going to make so that we at least have that information. So give me just 1 minute.
Dr. Brightley, can you hear me?
Yay, there you are.
Alrighty.
All right.
Well, I apologize for the technical difficulties there. So if you can hear me okay, I'll go ahead and get started.
Go for it.
All right. Well, welcome everybody, and thank you for joining us on today's call, which intends to provide current information on the rapidly evolving situation pertaining to novel coronavirus, also referred to as COVID-19. This offering has been made widely available with the intent to reach all Missouri emergency medical services. My name is Sam Vance. I'm the Chief of the Department of Health and Senior Services Bureau of EMS, and I'm joined today by our State EMS Medical Director, Dr. Sabina Brayton. Unfortunately, Dr. Williams is meeting with the governor right now, and he will not be able to join us, so he does send his regrets, but I will be giving an update on his behalf. We'd like to thank all of you for the proactive work and information sharing that has occurred to date to protect the health and safety of Missourians. This call is being recorded, and the recording will be posted on the DHSS website as long as the content remains current. All lines are currently muted. If you have questions, please submit them through the chat box. And at the conclusion of our remarks, we'll answer the questions in the order they're received. Given the anticipated participant volume, we ask that the questions be framed broadly and in the best interest of all participants. Specific questions pertaining to your agency only may be better addressed through email. So to give you all an update on the current numbers of patients tested, currently in the state of Missouri, as of 8 o'clock last night, there were 215 patients tested through the Missouri Department of Health Senior Services Lab. Out of those, 217 have tested negative, and there were 8 positive as of 8 o'clock last night. I have been informed there's another positive test as of this morning out of Cass County. However, I have not been able to confirm that. As far as the capability of the state health lab, within the last couple of days, the CDC has allowed the state to use their positive test as a final number without having to send that on to the CDC for confirmation. It was taking around 5 days for a turnaround time. So since that requirement is no longer in place, we're able to get those positive results within approximately 6 hours. There are numerous testing sites that are going up throughout the state, many of them private labs, and some of them are hospitals throughout the state that are now doing the testing. And we anticipate, as they begin to do that, that you will see the number of positive tests increasing throughout the state. It's the thought that there are many folks throughout the state who are carrying the coronavirus, but because of the limited amount of testing we've been able to do to this point, that they have not been identified. So it is the thought that you will see a spike in our numbers here within the next week. Excuse me. One of the things that I wanted to point out to all of you is that you should be receiving the emails that I've been sending out regarding any of the communications from the Bureau of EMS. If you're not currently on the listserv, please send me an email and I'll make sure that you get onto our listserv. Excuse me. And with that, on Monday, I should say, we did send out an email regarding the resource response plan and to release PPE from the state cache. That those requests began on Monday, and all of those requests will need to go through the healthcare coalitions. So I would encourage all of you who have your request to go onto our webpage, and you will find all the directions on how to make those requests through our webpage. In addition to that, we have also sent out information regarding clinical rotations for our EMT and paramedic students, and that the EMT test that was scheduled for this month has been canceled through NIEMT. At this point in time, the NIEMT does plan on doing the tests that are scheduled for April. However, that is dependent upon what happens within the next couple of weeks, and they will reevaluate that at the beginning of April. And we are currently working on guidelines for our education and training sites to begin their class online, and we hope to have that guidance out by the end of the day today. One of the things that we would encourage you all to do, if you're not doing it already, is to develop policies and procedures in conjunction with your medical directors on what to do if your staff become sick, if they become infected, and also to develop a screening process for when your staff arrive to work. I know that's a little difficult. However, it is something that is being encouraged by the Department of Health and the CDC, that if your employees arrive to work with the flu-like symptoms and they are running a fever of 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit or higher, that they should be sent home and quarantined for the 14 days and should be tested for the coronavirus. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and, well, there is one other thing that I forgot to mention here, that the DHSS COVID-19 hotline is available. That is on our webpage as well, and you should have received an email regarding that as well. The call center is currently receiving approximately 1,000 calls per day. They have increased the number of phone lines and staff to handle those calls. And so when initially went online, there was a fairly long wait time for folks. And now the average wait time for people to get their phone call answered is less than 5 minutes. And as I'm sure you can imagine, many of those phone calls are just from people who are panicked and frustrated and scared. So the folks on the phone lines are on average taking about 12 to 15 minutes with each one of those individuals. So having said that, I will go ahead and turn this over to Dr. Braithwaite.
Thanks, Sam. So as everyone can imagine, this is an experiment for us too, but we thought it was important to at least have a forum where we can start having conversations with the EMS community in the state, because as we all know, this is changing hour by hour, and we'd like to make sure that we're all on the same page as much as that is possible. So just a couple items from me. Sam already talked about the issue of force protection, which I think is key. The issue of how are we going to make sure that we not only take care of ourselves, but that we maintain capacity to respond. So doing things like screening and awareness and appropriate PPE use, monitoring what the most current recommendations are on PPE use, be it N95, be it surgical masks and so forth, because those things are changing minute by minute too through the CDC. I want to reinforce that I'm sure everybody else is experiencing the same thing that I am, which is a barrage of information from 1,000 different places. I strongly encourage you to stay tied to authoritative sources. So the state has put up a webpage. Everybody knows the CDC website. I would go to those things primarily. And use those as your first level resources, because it's really easy to have the waters muddied by a lot of the other things that are coming out there. So that's the first step. The second thing, again, reinforcing, I'm sure people are already starting to run out of PPE. If you're not on Sam's e-list, please get on it. He's sending out information like the sign up for how to get PPE through the state cash, because I'm pretty sure that's going to be something that's going to become necessary very shortly for a number of agencies. So if you're not on Sam's e-list, send Sam an email. He would love to hear from all of you and get you on that list so that you have the most current information. We are having conversations as well with SEMA about the ventilator cache, because we anticipate that it may not be long before we need that as well. So all those conversations are already starting to happen. Let's see. The next thing is we are developing on a regional level. I know the East region has, and the Southwest region. I've gotten copies of the regional protocols that are being developed. Wouldn't be surprised if there are ones in the other regions already. We do have under statute authority for the regional medical directors to create regional protocols that provide liability protection for some of these things that are way outside what we normally do. The East region in the Southwest region, we are going to be holding the Regional Medical Directors Committee meeting next week, just so that we can discuss these things and get them approved and pushed forward to the SAC for the statutory protection. Those include things like recommendations on dispatch screening, recommendations on PPE. They also incorporate the ability to transport to alternate destinations. So if you don't have those in your community already, partnerships with your health department and your healthcare coalitions may help develop strategies for alternate destinations for transporting patients so that the not significantly ill don't all clog up our hospitals that we know are going to be pretty taxed here very shortly. there are discussions about potential need to escalate to things like assessment and non-transport as this thing progresses. So those conversations are being had at the state level, and we'll just kind of have to see where that goes as this situation evolves minute by minute. So just be aware that those conversations are being had. So we will share that with you as we can. I think that was the main points that I wanted to bring up. More than anything, we wanted to kind of open this up for your questions, which I'm already looking at. And Dr. Sigler was going to help me manage those. Hang on a minute. Let me scroll back up and find you where we started. I think you were the first one, Jacob. So, Sam, are you seeing all the Zoom group chat questions that we've got?
Yeah, I am. I'm trying to find the first one there.
Well, the first one was, what was the time frame for requests to go through the Healthcare Coalition, which is where we're supposed to request the PPE and so forth?
Right. And so I don't know the answer to that question, but those are going through Paula Nicholson with the Office of Emergency Preparedness. However, I will find out the answer to that and get back with you. So with all these questions, we are recording this, and we'll be taking down any of the, any and all the questions, and the ones that we don't know the answer to, we'll get those answers. We'll put together an email and email out to everybody the answers, including that one.
And just so you're aware, we know we may not have the answers to a lot of these questions today, but part of the purpose of this is to have them collated so that we can push them forward to Dr. Williams or whoever needs to be able to answer them. Lynn County, we absolutely understand that if we follow some of the quarantine guidelines, especially our rural small agencies, with 5 to 10 people manning the units, that we're going to suddenly lose capacity very quickly. We're experiencing that in some of the hospitals as well, where very liberal quarantine guidelines are being used. Hi, Jacob. How's quarantine in the hotel room?
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So, I'm hoping that we're going to get some consistent guidance from the state there as this thing evolves, because if we all get quarantined, we're obviously on the first lines. And if all of us disappear, there's not going to be much left to take care of the sick people that come forward. So we're aware of that, and we expect that the recommendations on quarantine will evolve as this thing goes forward, because sitting everybody out for 2 weeks is probably not going to be a thing for long. So I expect that that will probably continue to evolve. Let's see, screening. Yes, I see that's good. We're doing the screening of on-duty personnel. That I think that's probably going to be a good practice. So at least if people are febrile, it makes sense to quarantine them. It may be COVID, it may just be the plain old flu, but it's just like anything else. We don't want to be sharing diseases with our patients. So I think that's a pretty reasonable thing to do. Sam, I'm going to punt this next one to you. Can you broadly describe how DHSS and the other state agencies are collaborating in response to COVID-19, and what does it look like in Missouri?
Sure. So currently at the state level, the State Emergency Management Association is up and running at a level 4, and the Emergency Response Center for DHSS is also up and running at an administrative level. As far as integration with the national response framework and at the national level, there are phone calls at the administrative level on a daily basis with the federal agencies, and that is where a lot of our guidance comes from at the state level, including the guidance from the CDC. So I hope that answers it at that 30,000 foot level.
The next question is how can an agency confirm an order was received for the state cash PPE supplies?
Again, those orders are going through the Healthcare Coalition and being oversaw by Paula Nicholson with Emergency Preparedness, but I will definitely get in touch with her and find out. Which to back up to that last question, The incident management team at DHSS meets on a daily basis. That includes weekends at noon, from noon to one, where we get an update on what's going on in the state, what's going on at the federal level, which just to follow up on that a little bit, as you're probably all aware, the federal funding has been released to the states, and the state of Missouri is currently has a committee put together to go over that funding and to determine how that funding is going to be allocated.
Next question is, do we have a reasonable idea of when the COVID-19 cases will peak? And I think the honest answer to that is we have no idea. And I think that is partly because we're only now in this country really getting able to test. So we have no idea what our numerator is, and we have no idea what our denominator is. So we have no idea who our asymptomatic carriers are that are running around the community. And we have, you know, we're just starting to confirm the tests on the people that are critically ill. So my gut feeling, non-official, not speaking on behalf of the state, is we're still distinctly on the upswing of this thing. I think there are a lot of people out there that probably are carriers and have not been identified. And depending on how rapidly the testing becomes universally available will depend on how quickly we get a denominator. But I would expect that this is going to continue to go up significantly. And if somebody else has other information, feel free to pipe up. What the quantity of ventilators in the state cache is, I don't know the exact number, but there are a whole bunch of them. There's actually, we're having a call on it tomorrow afternoon again. We're actually in the process of purchasing more. So they're a grunch and we're buying more. Sam, do you have any specific numbers?
You know, there was, it is discussed at this time that they're doing a double check on what is in the cache to determine the functionability and viability of all of those ventilators. The last count that I heard is somewhere around 100, I believe.
Okay, next question is looking for guidelines. When there's an employee that exhibits flu-like symptoms, or as to whether there's a requirement for testing, and mentioning that in the rural area, there's not a whole lot of capability for testing. And is there some specific plan of assistance for coverage in that small area, or are you relying on mutual aid? So I think first question, and again, Sam, feel free to chime in if you have other information. I think if you have an employee that's febrile, they have something that's contagious, whether it's COVID-19 or not, I don't know. But if they're febrile, they probably are infectious of whatever they're carrying, and probably a good idea for them not to work. Testing, honestly, we're not getting a whole lot of testing in the city either, so don't feel bad at this point. So I think if somebody's febrile, you should assume they're ill with something that they probably should not be sharing with their patients. And then the question about coverage in your small area, I think at this point you're relying on mutual aid agreements. And I think this is where it's really important for us to really use our regional EMS committees, where everybody's used to sitting down at a table together and everybody kind of knows what their regional resources are. I would encourage the regional committees to kind of take the lead here and be able to, help figure out what you can deal with internally in your region versus what we need to do with overlapping or bordering regions so that we make sure that we have coverage for the patients that need it. Sam, do you have anything different on that?
No, I think that answers it pretty good.
Next question is ESF-8 staffed at the state EOC? My understanding is it is, because I believe that was requested, I think maybe yesterday evening. My days are kind of running together. I'm sure I'm not the only one that has that problem. So The answer to that is yes, the ESF-8 should be staffed at the state EOC at this point. Next one, if employees are sent home with fevers to quarantine for 14 days, do those need to be reported by the employer? Sam, I'm giving you that one.
So if they are sent home with the thought that they are a person under investigation, that should be reported to your local health department, and they should be take the guidance from them on where they should go to be tested.
Okay, next question is, what's the recommendation for the disposal of used PPE? I would have to look up the actual official recommendation for that, but as far as I know, it should be regular trash. This is not Ebola that we're dealing with. So it shouldn't be hazardous waste at this point. It should be regular trash. Does anybody else have any specifics on that? We'll have to get you a definite answer on that, but my sense is it's regular trash at this point. All right, we'll put that in the queue to put in Sam's email for the definite answer on that. Considerations on if staffing or supplies are decreased to assist non-licensed personnel to assist with driving or hands-on help or using expired supplies if needed. So Sam and I actually both saw Minnesota has something, statute in place that deals with this kind of issue. So those are in some of the things that are being discussed at the state level. We don't have anything in statute at this point that allows that, but if this continues to escalate and we need assistance from the state as far as be it review from the Office of General Counsel or potentially action from the governor to allow those sorts of things, that those things are already out there being discussed. Sam, do you want to speak any more to that question?
Yes. Okay, thank you. I will see if I can pick up where Dr. Braithwaite left off. It appears that she may have lost her connection here. Let's see.
I'm back. Sorry, but I lost the whole chat.
Okay, I was just getting ready to pick up where you left off.
Well, feel free, because I lost the whole chat, so my bad.
Okay, let's see. I'm trying to find out because to go along with what Dr. Braithwaite was saying, there was some guidelines that the state of Minnesota has in regards to that. We do have statutes in place currently that allows for non-licensed personnel to assist with driving the ambulance. I believe that is in 190.105 without looking it up. But so, yes, whether it's firefighter, police officer, anyone who is not an EMT or paramedic, it does allow for that. Since we are under a state of emergency from the governor, there are other areas where folks that where you need to make adjustments in things such as driving can be made. We are currently looking at other avenues of approach as far as things where that the state can put in place to help alleviate some of the issues that we're starting to see.
Jeff, can you read the next question? Because I lost everything going backwards.
I mean, I can read this here too, okay, if you'd like. So collectively speaking, our EMS agencies still plan on hosting EMS students. I cannot speak for all the EMS agencies on the line here. However, that is up to the individual EMS agency if you'd like to host students or not. So that decision would be made at the agency level.
So yeah, on that issue, there have been some conversations in the one of the EMS directors, medical directors groups about that issue, about whether students should be allowed to rotate. You know, that's a philosophical discussion that is really going to be up to the EMS program and the agency. You know, we're training folks to respond to this sort of thing on a daily basis is their profession. You know, knowing how to properly put on your PPE and who to put your PPE on for, probably part of what we need to learn. So, but again, then we don't want to spread this. So putting people in that situation is a decision that needs to be made carefully. So I think that's something that's between the EMS program and the agency that would be hosting them to decide.
So Dr. Braithwaite, is your chat box still down?
Well, it came back partly, I think. I don't know if I've missed any. Comments about the EMT class going and doing clinicals, but they have to screen, which makes perfect sense. The next question that I'm seeing is there a state list of approved testing facilities in our areas? And I think the answer to that is probably your health department should know the answer to that. Your local health department, is that correct, Sam?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Where is the list of the approved testing facilities in the state and in different areas? And I think the health department should be the one that should know the answer to that.
Yeah, look on the DHSS webpage, the COVID-19 webpage.
All right, so there you go. That's where the approved testing facilities are. Next question I see is, are urgent care facilities being considered as alternate transport facilities to keep hospitals from being potentially overburdened? So I think that's something your region's going to have to discuss with your urgent care centers. Urgent care centers have no obligation under EMTALA. So I don't know what their level of willingness would be to accept people that may not have the ability to pay because they have no legal obligation to care for them. So it may be that hospitals are setting up things that are offsite. It may be that the health department's setting up things that are offsite. Like I know one of our health departments, we know which one of the negative pressure rooms, should we have somebody that, you know, that we think is a realistic case. We've also discussed, you know, people are starting to do drive-through testing. Some of the hospitals are sponsoring things like that. So what your regional potential alternate transport sites are is something I think that your region's going to figure out with your healthcare coalition, which may or may not end up including urgent care facilities, honestly. And if somebody has something set up already as far as alternate destinations, feel free to pipe up and share with the group. Let's see. A number of comments about people that have stopped ride-alongs due to the limited PPE, which makes perfect sense. And I'm just going to make a request that we use the PPE appropriately. We don't have a whole lot of it. So when we do things like interfacility transfers with a broken shoulder, I shouldn't see an N95 on somebody's face, hypothetically speaking, of course. So please use the PPE for the patients that need PPE. People with broken shoulders do not need an N95 mask, not today and not any other day. Let's see. Mercy has postponed all external education, not allowing student riders, same thing, to limit exposure in PPE. And let's see. Right. And a lot of people are doing meetings via Zoom just to keep the social distancing, which we've all heard so much about, which makes sense. There's some nice simulations on why social distancing works. So there we are.
And briefly, we are working with the educational and training institutions on, whether they're postponing classes or moving their graduation dates and course completion dates back to accommodate the clinical rotations.
Right. Let's see. If a crew member becomes symptomatic, does the entire crew need to be quarantined? Again, I think that's going to be a decision that's going to be with your health department and who they're going to require to be quarantined. And like I said, I think the quarantine requirements are going to be a moving target here as more and more people get exposed. And what is considered a real exposure is going to, again, also be a moving target. Early on, it seems like the quarantine decisions are being made on if you were you know, potentially somewhere near somebody and not even necessarily within 6 feet of them, you're getting quarantined. I think that as this thing goes forward, you're going to have had some pretty significant exposure to, or be febrile to get quarantined. But I think we're going to have to hang on what the CDC's recommendations are for that, because that's going to be a moving target. Are there other questions? I wish we had more definitive information for you. Go ahead, Sam.
So, Dr. Braithwaite, I did receive a question this morning regarding our PSAP, our dispatch centers, in regards to the guidance from the CDC that they only ask questions regarding coronavirus if the patient is calling in with the complaint of flu-like symptoms. And they are wanting to expand that to asking those questions of every single caller. So I wanted to get your opinion as the state EMS medical director, how you feel if our dispatcher should be asking every single caller if they have a cough, cold, fever, that type of thing.
I'm going to take a deep breath. I mean, in the environment we work in, I think we should assume that people have been exposed and act accordingly. So anything that is coughing, sneezing, dripping, oozing, or whatever demands the appropriate PPE. So if it's oozing and dripping, you should wear gloves. If it's sneezing and coughing, you should wear eye protection and a mask and a gown. And, you know, I think that's should be that way every day. I mean, most of you probably remember when we went through Ebola and we started doing all kinds of crazy things that, yeah, this reinforces that we need to be using appropriate PPE and common sense every day. And that's as politically correct as I can be.
Sabina, local lessons learned down in Springfield. Just because you ask the questions doesn't mean that you're going to get the right answer. And just because they don't call in with those symptoms doesn't mean they shouldn't have the questions asked. So I won't go any further than that, but I have two in quarantine. So,
right. So we can ask. Sometimes people tell us the truth and sometimes they don't. So, yeah. Another question, concerns about entering nursing facilities. So, I actually heard from a doc out east that some nursing facility informed the EMS service that they could not come into their nursing facility until they were screened, which I thought was a pretty brave statement from the nursing home.
So Dr. Braithwaite, yes, that has been an issue with a few of the nursing homes. There was a letter sent out from our section of long-term care to the nursing homes that explained to them that EMS personnel are essential personnel and they do not have to go through their screening criteria on entrance or exit of the nursing home. However, as Dr. Braithwaite pointed out earlier, your crews need to be practicing proper PPE upon entrance into the nursing home, which includes surgical mask, gown, and eye protection. Only if the patient's complaint identifies them as a PUI should your staff be wearing their N95s. However, if you are experiencing a problem with a nursing home or long-term care facility, trying to hold crew up from entrance or exit to the nursing home, please contact me and I will forward that on to our long-term care section so they can address it with the nursing home.
Hey Sam, it's Bob Patterson with Mercy. I just relate, we've had probably everything across the board. Patients being brought out to us, asking us to do some decon before going in. And we've just asked our folks to be cooperative and take the high road. If we can prevent, you know, something from happening, then I think it's a good thing. And I think they're just being overly cautious, and we're trying to support them in their decisions to protect their patients and their staff. So it takes 30 seconds to a minute to do all those things, and we're just cooperating. And I think that sets the tone of cooperation with those facilities.
Absolutely. And I think that's a good approach to take. And I, the one incident that we had that was really the only true complaint that we received was they were called to this particular nursing home for an unresponsive patient, and the patient really was unresponsive. And as they were trying to exit the facility, as they were bagging the patient, the staff wanted to ask them to complete their screening criteria, and that is where the issue ensued.
Yeah, it certainly, it's entry to facilities is where we're seeing the interaction, not on departure. But okay. I agree with that. That shouldn't be happening.
And I think that's something where if you're routinely screening your providers when they come to work, that's something that you can at a regional level let the long-term care facilities know. We're screening people when they come into work every day. We promise. We've done it as a region. We don't need to do it every time we walk into your nursing home, which is a lot of times a day. So, you know, maybe that may be as a system solution that can help at least limit some of that time sink. And then...
Yeah, that's a great point. Sam, I don't know if there's any plans for Missouri, but the group may be aware Arkansas has required that of their EMS providers. So we've implemented that kind of systematically at Mercy, that we're doing that pre-shift screening.
Yeah, it's not something that we can mandate, but it's definitely a recommendation. And I am currently working on a guideline for that, and we'll hopefully have that out within the next couple of days.
And that's, again, that thing that Sam said at the beginning about working with your regional healthcare coalition will help with some of those things where we can put some of these systemic things in place. I'm reading this thing from Oregon County Ambulance, which just makes me sad for so many reasons. Sam, is that something that you can follow up on? Because trying to sneak a known person under investigation and sticking them out in the parking lot and not warning the other healthcare providers is something that is absolutely not okay. And I think that a phone call from somebody important probably would help discourage that behavior going forward, because that's just terrible.
Yeah, if you all would get in touch with me and give me all the details on that and what facility it was and whatnot, and then we can follow up on that.
Yeah, and anybody that has a screening process or something that they want to share, that, again, we don't want to be everybody to be reinventing the wheel, and the more things are consistent, because a lot of this is sort of non-negotiable. Screening processes are pretty straightforward. That if that's something that people want to adopt on a regional level, that's helpful, because then there's consistency across the board, and that helps us reassure the other healthcare partners what we're doing. So. Yeah. Okay, good. Looks like Oregon County is already dealing with that. But yeah, it'd be nice for the state to be aware of that too. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other questions? If this is something you all think has value, I know you're meeting as regions. If you think that having this opportunity is valuable to the state EMS, please let Sam know if this is something that we should plan on doing on a weekly or interim basis. We know we don't have all the answers, but at least this helps us sort of figure out what people are dealing with and try to figure out some unified approach so that we're not all just living on our own islands, because we definitely are all hunkered down in this together for sure.
Yeah. So absolutely. If you think a weekly briefing would be helpful, yeah, we can definitely set that up. Or if you think a bi-weekly or monthly, So seeing some of the comments in here that looks like a weekly update would be helpful. So I'll get together with Dr. Brakely and we'll see what we can schedule.
Sounds good. Unless there's other questions, we really appreciate everybody, everything you guys are doing every day. Please stay safe. Take care of yourselves.
Hey, Sabina, it's Siegler. I have one last question I just thought of. Stop. Can you guys discuss how EMS Compact or Compact will affect the providers in the state or coming from outside of the state?
Yeah. And you know, my apologies. I forgot to mention that earlier. That yes, as of Monday, the Interstate Compact has gone into effect using paper mode. And the primary reason that the commission voted to do that was specifically to help address the COVID-19 issue. So I will be sending out by the listserv the announcement on the Interstate Compact a little later today. And as far as how that will impact our responses, currently our neighboring states that are part of the compact is Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, and I believe it's Tennessee. So at least with those folks, and particularly up in the Kansas City area, it's not really, as far as we're concerned, a whole lot different than what we're currently doing with folks who are licensed in other states, as far as being able to transport patients in and out of Missouri and vice versa. And at the national level, we're currently looking at if someone home state is Kansas and they come to work within Missouri, how many days can they work in Missouri without having to obtain a Missouri license? And it's being discussed whether that's 30 days or 60 days, something similar to like a driver's license.
All right. Now, did anyone ask about family members of employees who are exhibiting symptoms? Right, where the family member has symptoms and not the employee. I think the recommendations, one of the things I shared with the regional medical directors group that is the whole, is like handouts that we're giving on how to do appropriate isolation. If there's a family member, the isolation recommendations is that they sort of stay in a room by themselves as much as possible, that they not share a bathroom, that they not share, dishes and things like that. So I would hope the employee would let you know that they have a family member who has symptoms and see what testing capability or what have you that are available. But the family member is the one that needs to be isolated from the employee, I would hope. I think that's the current recommendation, is awareness would be nice so that you can monitor that employee closely, but unless somebody else has different information.
Yeah, that's really something that you need to handle at the agency level with your medical director in developing those guidelines, as different places have different guidelines. I know that here at the state, the guideline is if a spouse, significant other, or if your children are exhibiting signs and symptoms of coronavirus, to include at least a fever of 100.4 or higher, then the employee would also have to stay home as well. But again, that is something that you all need to discuss at your agency level.
And like I said, I think the isolation thing, the quarantine thing, is going to evolve as this thing goes forward, or there's not going to be anybody left. Is anybody aware of any larger hospital or EMS systems providing decon of ambulances if we transport patients to them? I don't have that information. Does anybody else have intel on that?
And no, I don't have any information on that either.
Mark, are you aware of anything in your region?
Not as a matter of practice, although I think assistance could be expected if asked for.
Okay. Anybody else?
We've placed a kit or a cart, excuse me, out in the ambulance bays at our south facility with the necessary approved disinfectant and to be used when ambulances come in and have these respiratory related cases. So
hopefully it's locked up, because I notice a lot of our things are getting legs from the patients. Gloves, sanitizer, everything, masks. Other thoughts? All right, well, if Sam and I will work on scheduling another, another couple of meetings, so that we'll have them at least on deck for the next couple of weeks as this thing grows. And, you know, if you haven't signed up for the, to get on Sam's list, please do so. And then kind of keep the state COVID page and the CDC COVID pages marked so that you have those. And I think that's all we had, right, Sam?
That's all I have. And I thank everybody for joining today and appreciate everyone's participation.
Thanks all for joining. We appreciate it. Stay safe out there.
Thanks, Sam and Sabina. We appreciate it.